Okay, everybody, good morning. Thank you for being here. My name is Erna Arneson. I'm a board member of Watermark, and I'm delighted to welcome you to the session called The Pay Equity Tipping Point, Make a Difference in Your Pay Now, breakout session. That's the session you're at now, and I'm a member, a proud board member and member of Watermark. And it is, as you know, the Bay Area's premier women's executive leadership community. In addition to producing today's wonderful conference, Watermark also produces over 50 events each year throughout the Bay Area. I encourage you to stop by the Watermark booth at the exhibit hall sometime today to learn more about Watermark's programs and also our special trial membership for emerging executives, which is a $99 program. As your host for the session, I'll be briefly describing the session setup for all of you, and our moderator will join us momentarily, and she'll introduce the topic and the panelists. So my job is pretty easy. There will be an open discussion among the panel members after the talk, and then a Q&A for the last 15 or 20 minutes. We're asked to end at 11 o'clock. Microphones will be available, so if you'll go to the mic when you have questions at when Vicki lets you know. It's now my pleasure to introduce our amazing moderator. Her name is Vicki Pinchon. She's a best-selling author and co-founder of the company She Negotiates. Her mission is to equip women with the knowledge, skills, and confidence to close their own personal wage gap before passing on the secret to all the rest of us. Let me introduce Vicki. Thank you, everybody.
So we have women here for you today who are at the very top of their professions, who come from journalism, public policy, and the business world. So I think we've got it covered. All I do is to help individual women close their own individual pay gap, to bring themselves up to equity. We actually do pretty well. We usually run about 20 to 35% higher than first offers and for raises, which would make us brilliant. But we're not brilliant. We just find out what your market value is, and then we close your pay gap. And you should know that your employer has everyone's pay, unlike you. And when your employer looks across the company, the institution, the university, they see the pay gap and they want to close it. I have a friend who is the, she's not the dean, I don't know, she's provost or something of a major Ivy League university, and she told me that she saw her entire colleges, the College of Arts and Sciences, pay. And she was shocked, and this was only 5 years ago. She said, if we close the pay gap, the gender pay gap, it would shut down the university, the entire university. So we believe that your employer is looking to mitigate your employer's risk by bringing women up to pay parity, but is not doing so for everyone because they can't. So there's the opportunity. So I wanted to just briefly tell a story. I was looking at my notes last night, and I realized that we here are living in an age of a fire hose of unsolicited advice about how we can be better, how we can fit ourselves better into a workplace that, frankly, was simply not designed with us in mind. It is not the fault of the guys that the workplace was designed for them, because they came into it after it was designed for guys too. So there's no blame to pass around, but there is action to undertake. So I was reading Bloomberg and Forbes and at The Atlantic, and also some women's career digital journals last night. And I just made a quick list of things that you should be doing. I thought I'd share them with you. You should be deepening your voice. You should definitely not cry. You should have a stronger handshake, although I tell you, my hand's been broken by at least two women here this morning. You should avoid upspeak and vocal fry. I know what upspeak is. I don't really know what vocal fry is, but I'll have to look it up because clearly I'm going to have to take that advice. You should ask for more money, but you should be very, very nice about it. You should read the sports page. You should learn to play golf. You should seek sponsors, mentors, and perhaps form a personal board of directors. How many women have children in the room? You got time for this? You should brag about your accomplishments, but very, very modestly. You should never, ever curse. And from a Princeton mother from a few years ago, you should find a good provider before you graduate from college, because heaven knows they'll all be taken if you wait. So all of this makes my generic woman's head explode. So I want to tell you a quick story about subverting a male-dominated workplace. This is a story from a law firm that has offices in my town, which is Los Angeles. These women in this law firm who had a women's initiative, how many people have women's initiatives in your law firms? How many people have women's initiatives in your places of work? Okay, down. How many women feel that their women's initiatives have done something positive for their careers? Well, there are a few. Okay, so these women told me that they had a women's initiative beginning sometime in 2005, and that it was all hearts and flowers, and that there were no goals. They had a budget, a very, very small budget. The firm had no goals. The women could do what they wanted. They had speakers like me to talk about negotiation and, you know, vocal fry and upspeech and golfing. And they had networking and mixers and, you know, for a law firm, the goal is to become a partner, which requires you to have clients. But it doesn't require you just to have clients. It requires you to engage in a cage match for something called origination credit for that client that you brought to the firm. How many have client-facing roles in the room? Okay, you're developing business, right? How many people are having cage matches over origination credit or whatever you call it outside the law firm? Okay, so a lot of women genuinely don't want to do that. So she said, the head of the women's initiative said, sometime around 2010, we decided to grow our women's initiative a pair of balls. And that's how women lawyers speak, which is why I like them. And they said, I said, well, that's interesting. What did you do? And she said, well, we decided that we were just going to start exerting power. And here's how origination credit works in a big law firm. So there are employment attorneys, and there are intellectual property attorneys, and there are antitrust attorneys. And so if you get a client, you go to a networking event, you generate a client, you're an employment lawyer, somebody else is an antitrust lawyer, this person has an antitrust case. And so you refer it to the practice head. Now, law firms aren't really managed. It's a jungle. So almost everything that happens in a law firm is folkway. So the folkway is to send it to the practice head. And who do you think the practice head is gender-wise? Practice head is almost always a man. It's still an incredibly male-dominated profession. Women leave in droves. So you send it to the man. He has his deputies and lieutenants and marshals, and they figure out, and you fight for origination credit. So these women said, we decided we were going to refer within the women's initiative. They just did it. They didn't ask anybody for permission. They didn't say they were going to do something different. If an employment lawyer who was in the women's initiative met somebody with an antitrust case, she referred it to a woman in the antitrust department who was in the women's initiative. Now, in response to the few people, if there are any who say, but what about merit? They did go out of their way to say, that all the women's in the Women's Initiative were competent attorneys. So stop, she says. So in the matter of 2 years, these women not only made the firm better for themselves, but they also instituted new policies. They became such a power in the firm that other practice groups began to ask them for their support in making, say, an antitrust attorney candidate a partner that year. And they went over all of the, evaluations to see whether or not people were being judged subjectively, which allows implicit bias to come in. And they made sure that there was at least one woman who was made partner every year. Okay? Nobody allowed them to do this. They simply did it. They subverted the system that favored male senior lawyers and made the firm a better place for the women to be. So I'm going to first introduce you to J. Newton Small, who is a political correspondent for Time. She is a White House correspondent. She says from time to time, I would call her a White House correspondent. When she said, when I was on Air Force One, I swooned. She has written a book called Broad Influence, How Women Are Changing the Way America Works. Her name is J. Newton Small. Please greet her warmly.
Wow, thank you so much, Watermark, for having me here. my book originally came about 2.5 years ago when I wrote a story for Time magazine about the women of the Senate coming together during the government shutdown to restart the negotiations to reopen the government when none of the men would talk to each other. And I got really interested in the idea of critical mass. So it was the first time that the Senate was 20% women, and they had a huge impact on that session. They ended up producing 75% of the legislation that passed that session. And it turns out that, you know, there's a huge body of research out there that shows that whether you're in a legislature or a corporate board, a Navy ship, or an appellate court, when women reach between 20 and 30% in any of those bodies, they really begin to have an impact. They really begin to change the way things are done. And so my book looks at all those areas where they do this and they achieve it. And one of my favorite stories from the book and talking about women sort of achieving power in this critical mass is from the West Wing. So the West Wing, under the Obama administration in 2009, was actually an incredibly unfriendly place for women. I don't know if you remember this, but by November of 2009, the women in the White House were so disgruntled that they had this very acrimonious dinner with the president in the residence, where they basically said, "We're not being listened to. We're not achieving anything. This is ridiculous." And the president listened to all of their complaints and basically was unsympathetic and kind of said, "You guys need to step it up. The guys are doing what I need them to do, and I need you guys to really kind of start relying on each other. Start like becoming a cabal of your own and step up your game." And almost offhandedly, he suggested that they start meeting regularly, because a lot of the women, even though they made up 39% of the West Wing, it was by far the largest percentage of women of any White House, then they had critical mass. They didn't really know each other. So some were from New York, some were from Chicago, some were from California and D.C., and so they took the president's advice and they started meeting sort of every couple of weeks or every month for lunches and dinners, and they started to become friends. And they actually started to really back each other up. So when they were left out of meetings, they would sort of text each other and be like, "Hey, come to the Roosevelt room. They're doing something over here." Or, you know, when they couldn't make it to the Roosevelt room, they would take notes and hand them off to their female friends and say, "Here's what happened, so you're up to date." Whenever they were in meetings with, you know, other male members of the White House, and I think every woman in the room has probably had this happen, where you are in a room and you say something, and 10 minutes later a guy says the exact same thing, and everyone's like, "Oh my God, genius." And you're like, "Yeah, I just said that." And so the women of the White House started to say, "Hey, you know what? Kathy had that great idea like 10 minutes ago. Wasn't that great, you know, when Kathy had that idea?" So they really kind of started to back each other up. And there was, it kind of ended, the chapter ends with this great scene where it was during the 2011 grand budget grand bargain negotiations, and it was a Sunday, and the president was meeting in the Oval Office with David Plouffe and Larry Summers, and it was yet another meeting where the women had been excluded. At this point, you had two deputy White House chiefs of staff, Alyssa Mastromonaco, who was in charge of the budget, and Nancy Ann DeParle, who was in charge of policy, and they'd been left out of this meeting, and you can't do a grand bargain without the budget or the policy. And they also had Stephanie Cutter, who was in charge of messaging. And so the three of them heard about the meeting, and they gathered in front of the Oval Office, and they basically were like, you know what? We're just going to barge in. And so they walked into the Oval Office, and they sat down, and they just started participating like everything was normal. And the president was like, hi, guys. And they were like, hi. And the men got the message, and they were never left out again. So it's really actually cool. I was on a panel with some women from the White House from the second term a few weeks ago, and they were talking about how now this, like, the West Wing is this total yaya sisterhood, and it's like totally run by women. So it's just, it's changed a lot. But there is still a pay gap in the White House. It's 87 cents to the dollar, and that's something that they still need to work on. And pay gap is a really important thing. So I'm part of the millennial generation. I'm in the upper cusp of millennials, sort of millennial Gen X. And one of the hallmarks of my generation is the assumption of gender equality. It's, you know, we're just born assuming that women are equal. And it isn't until we really get into the workforce, I think, that we begin to realize that our assumptions are actually not a reality. And it's, you know, and we're really beginning, I think, as a generation to act on that. So you see Taylor Swift starting to get up at the Grammys and say, hey, I want recognition. Or Jennifer Lawrence demanding equal pay. Or Lena Dunham and Lenny. Or Emma Watson starting a feminist book club. And so there's this movement that you see that's really interesting that's happening amongst millennials who actually suffer from the smallest amount of pay gaps in America, only 88 cents to the dollar. And yet, right, only 88 cents to the dollar. But they, you know, they are really beginning to demand, you know, recognition and demand equal pay. And I think it's a fascinating thing. And but the only way we're really going to get equal pay is if we have critical actors. And so one of the reasons why the women of the Senate were so powerful in that session, producing so much legislation, was because they sat atop more than half of the committees that session. They either chaired or were ranking members on the committees of 11 out of the 20 Senate committees. So just having those critical actors reduces the sort of sheer number between to less than 20% or 20%. And that's the most that's the most important glass barrier for us to break, and the hardest one to break, because there's very different standards for women seeking executive office than it is seeking legislative office. So all the strengths that women have or are perceived to have, because obviously women are not unilateral, but when they run for legislatures or for boards, this sort of idea that we are really good at consensus building, at finding win-win scenarios, that helps us get onto boards or into legislatures, but it actually hurts us with executive offices. And so it's, you know, less than 5% of CEOs in America of Fortune 1000 companies are women. Only 6 governors out of our 50 governors, and less than 17% of mayors in America are women. And obviously, we've never had a female president or even a nominee of a party. And that's because you face this toughness test, this capability test, that in order to be an executive that you don't face for other jobs. And it's incredibly difficult needle for women to sort of thread, to be both tough and likable. Because then it's really easily crossing over to becoming a bitch. And you see that even today with Hillary Clinton and with Carly Fiorina running for president, where you have, you know, Bernie Sanders, like, there's, you know, can yell and scream and show passion. And when Hillary tries to yell and scream and show passion, she comes off as shrill. Everyone's like, my God, why is mom screaming at me? You know, she has to prove that she's capable. She doesn't have the same luxury of being a pragmatic, you know, of being a dreamer like Bernie is, or even like Donald Trump is. I mean, if Hillary had said, let's build a, you know, let's get Mexico to build a wall, you know, or let's have a $15 trillion healthcare plan, voters' heads would explode. They'd be like, no, you have to be pragmatic. And so she's sort of forced into this subconscious role of the kind of pragmatic mom who's like, no, Bernie, we can't afford that jet ski. We have to pay for college. And it's really sad to me that there is this massive disconnect between millennial women and Hillary, right? So millennial women, she cannot seem to appeal to them. And the best explanation for this I ever heard was a 22-year-old. I was covering the campaign in New Hampshire, and she was at a Bernie event. She'd been to both Bernie events and Hillary events. It was her first time she was voting. And she was saying, well, you know, I'm going to vote for Bernie, and here's why. When you go to a political event, it's like going on a date. And Bernie sweeps you off your feet. And it's like revolution and passion, and I'm going to change the world. And it's like free college and free healthcare and it's awesome. And she's like, and then you go on a date with Hillary and it's like going on a date with an actuary who's like talking about like your mortgage payments and taxes. And it's like really boring. And you know it's important, but you're not going to vote for it. And so with that, I'm going to leave you. It's my stop time. I'm just going to leave you with the thought that without these critical actors, without these CEOs, without these presidents, without, you know, frankly, Nancy Pelosi, who was Speaker of the House and who single-handedly increased female representation in the Democratic caucus from 19% to 36%, without those actors, we're never going to get to critical pay. And that is the most key component to getting us there. Thank you.
Jay, you can tell she's a millennial because she can fit twice as many words into every sentence as anybody from my generation. So you are now going to hear from Dr. Heidi Hartman, who is a serious women's policy wonk. Her credentials are in your folders, and I'm not going to go through them because it's too frightening, and we'll all say, oh my God, we're not doing enough. What you should know is that she's a MacArthur Fellow, and she founded the Institute for Women's Policy Research, which is the leading American think tank informing women's policy issues. And she's here to talk to us about structural change on, I think, a global level. But we might be talking national today. But you're going to hear from somebody who has serious depth in women.
Hi, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here, to see so many of you up at this hour. I'm always amazed at how early business-oriented conferences start. It's interesting. I'm an economist by training, and I just want to tell you a little bit about how I got there. My mom was a very hardworking woman, and most of the time I knew her, she was a single mother because she had divorced my father when I was about four. They were both German immigrants. They had come over separately, and my father turned out to be a gambler, and as far as I know, he never really had a job. So my mother worked at primarily low-wage jobs. She had graduated from high school in Germany, but, you know, she didn't speak English that well. She worked in factories. Eventually, she got a job she really liked, which was as a saleswoman in a fabric store, because my mother loved to sew. When I went off to college, most of my clothes had been made by my mom. So in studying, in my high school, math and science were especially challenging, so I thought I'd be a math major. But when I got to Swarthmore College, I fell kind of in love with economics, which I had taken as a freshman, part of my distributional requirement, get rid of that social science, which I didn't think I was going to need. But I really liked it because it was dealing with real-world problems. And I kept my math background. I stayed a math minor, which is helpful when you go into economics. And I happened to be lucky, I think, in a way, that I started my graduate work at Yale University right at about the time women's liberation was really getting going. We had our consciousness groups, we had our demonstrations, we demonstrated in front of the Yale administration building that we had to have childcare 24/7, you know, free, and those kinds of demands were very much in the air at that time. So it was a lot of fun, and that encouraged me to study women in economics, and that's what I've been doing ever since. So I can tell you that when I entered the labor market, the wage ratio was at 60%, making the wage gap 40%. And that had been there quite a while. And so I can say that in the time I've been in the labor market, half of that wage gap has disappeared. As you heard Jay say, it's 79% ratio now. That wage gap has fallen from 40% to about 20%, so half of that wage gap has disappeared. And when I first started studying women in the labor market, you really, you know, with that 40% gap, I mean, you're like, what is going on here? You know, how is it that women are earning so much less than men? And the other thing you would notice is the extent of segregation. There were so many women in women-only jobs, elementary school teacher, nursing, and so many men in male-only jobs, engineer, truck driver, and so on. Some of those jobs have changed, have really integrated. The ones that require college education, much more integrated. There didn't used to be any female journalists on TV. No female newscasters when I was a child. That's one that's integrated. Real estate sales, you can think of a bunch of medicine, law now, a bunch of them that integrated, and they largely did so not only because I think of the changing times in the society, birth control pill, very important. A lot of women were able to complete college, which they hadn't been able to do before. So two or three things happened at the same time. One, big changes in public policy. Civil Rights Act of 1964, Equal Pay Act of 1963, Title IX of 1972. Title IX, all of a sudden, women could get into Yale Law School, Yale Medical School. At the time, I was married to a law student at Yale, and I think there were about 9 women in his entering class, maybe fewer, actually. But we had one of the first classes on women in the law there, which I was able to take as an economics graduate student. So the change has really been enormous, but there are a whole host of occupations that haven't changed at all. Plumber, electrician, carpenter, and police and fire only slowly. You know, police officer, firefighter. San Francisco Bay Area, a lot of firefighters female, I think 15% to 20%. New York City, 1% or 2%. So, you know, differences across the country. And of course, you will also see this kind of segregation in jobs by race and ethnicity, and a much larger larger wage gap and a lower pay ratio for women of color. So for black women and Hispanic women, on average, they make less than white women do. Asian American women make more. And part of that is probably because, on average, they have a higher education level. So I wanted to talk about what women have done and then move on to some public policy areas. So women have done two things that are fantastic for raising their pay. One, going to college more, getting a lot of education. Now, as you know, getting more degrees than men at every level, right? Bachelor's, master's, PhD, professional degrees. Not every single major, like engineering, but on average, they're getting more degrees at every level. And they just flooded into the labor market. I like to say they just marched into the labor market, and even a recession usually doesn't slow them down. Only this last recession and the one before did women's labor force participation dip a little, but not nearly as much as men's dipped in this recession. And they just keep marching on. It's, you know, work and planning for your career over your lifetime. That's something I think that women really understand. So those two things, we economists call that human capital. You brought up your human capital by working, staying on the job, getting labor market experience, and then getting the education that you need. So I like to say that in a way, women have done just about all they can do to get that wage gap to go down. Now that they're ahead of men in education and almost equal in terms of labor market experience. And so we have to look, I think, for some other areas of where we can look. Now, I'm sure a lot of you are following the Bernie Sanders campaign. I follow it so I know, you know, what the competition is doing. And I would say that, you know, he's really big on the 1% and what we should do for the other 99%. And there's a lot of wage gap remedies that are very popular among, you know, the Bernie Sanders followers. And these are things like raise the minimum wage, strengthen collective bargaining, increase paid sick days, very good at that in California. You have paid sick days. You even have paid maternity leave in California and paid parental leave, right? You have both. And that's pretty fantastic. And it's mandated for all employers. And San Francisco has just increased the pay by asking employers to pay the other half of it. But the state of California is also raising the pay for maternity leave and parental care leave. So these are things that, when you look at them, they're going to help everyone, not just women, but women and men. And they're going to especially bring up the bottom. And as it happens, more women are at the bottom. 2/3 of minimum wage workers are at the bottom in this country. So anything like that that brings up the bottom is going to help women more. So that's one important way to help women. But I don't hear as much about, and I think we should hear as much about, all of those old laws, like the Equal Pay Act, like the Civil Rights Act, like Title IX. And we're seeing them used in new ways. Sexual harassment on campus, suing colleges under Title IX. That's a new approach that wasn't happening when I was a student or graduate student. And I think for Title VII and equal pay, it's never too late to use those. Whoops, okay. I'll just mention the Lilly Ledbetter Act, which, of course, the Obama administration likes to make a big deal out of. And I'm like, what's the big deal? All that happened was that the law reverted to where it was before the Supreme Court made a stupid decision. It didn't give anybody any new rights. It just restored the rights that women had always had to bring a lawsuit whenever they found out that they were getting equal pay, instead of within 180 days of when they started work. I kind of felt like every woman in America should have sued her employer at 6 months, because otherwise she wouldn't be able to do anything before Lilly Ledbetter was passed and fixed it. So I'm just going to end with the last area, because I know I've already been told stop. And that's what in the 70s and 80s we used to call comparable worth. And in case you've never heard of it, it would be the idea that, for example, a nurse and an engineer should be paid more alike each other. They both have a four-year professional degree, a lot of science, and they enter the workplace right away. And the engineer is one of the highest paying occupations. The nurse is one of the highest paying female occupations. It's not a badly paying occupation at all, but it sure isn't paying what engineers are paid. And to give a Silicon Valley example, suppose, close your eyes, suppose for a moment, every single coder in Silicon Valley were female, and every single systems engineer were male. And would you not think that maybe the coders might start to think, you know, we're getting really rock bottom wages and they are making so much. I mean, don't we have almost as much as they do? I mean, shouldn't we be at least half what they get paid or three quarters what they get paid? Those kinds of ideas would enter your mind because there's, a cultural tendency to devalue what women do, which was mentioned here. So that's a third area that I think we need to work on. So I'll just stop there. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we're going to have a question and answer period. So I know all these speakers are speaking fast because we really want to hear from you and what you really need. So they haven't spoken their last words. You're going to have an opportunity to talk to them. So thank you so much, Jenny, for that. And I look forward to the audience's questions to you. Finally, we have Jenny Carlier, who I'm embarrassed to say I didn't ask how to pronounce her last name. I'm hoping that's close. She's a talent. She's a West Coast. She's the West Region Talent Leader at Ernst & Young LLP, and she has had as many as 27,000 people under her, probably not control, but jurisdiction. She's going to talk about the most dangerous negotiation you can have, which is one that you don't know that you're having. But she's also going to tell you a Middle Eastern love story.
You know, I have to say, someone who will be honest and tell you I've been intimidated at various points in my career and mostly by men, it's actually really heartfelt to be intimidated by these three amazing women. So it's actually a really good feeling. Before I get into my story, actually, if you will indulge me, I'd like to throw a question out to the audience. Can you give me a show of hands if you've been faced with a decision that was rooted by your family or your personal life that had an impact on your own career? Great, wow. Okay, so hopefully my story's gonna resonate, and for those that didn't raise your hand, hopefully some of my mistakes and some of the lessons learned will help you in your future career. So just to kind of step back and set some context, I made partner 12 years after being at the firm, and at the point I had spent and have still spent my entire career at EY. And for those of you who may not be familiar with the organizational structure of a professional services firm, the partner is the highest rank. Now, obviously, there's different roles and responsibilities you can take on as a partner, but in terms of title, it's the highest ranked title. And so I was a few years into my partner career, maybe 2 or 3 years in, and it was the first time that I probably made 100% based on a rooted personal decision. I went to the firm and I asked them, will you transfer me to the Middle East? And you can just imagine the looks on people's faces. And after about 3 years of transatlantic dating, a very charming Australian man, who's now my husband, so there is a happy ending to the story, we decided, he was living in Dubai, working in Uganda, and I was living and working in Silicon Valley. And we're like, you know, if this relationship's going to go anywhere, we got to geographically realign ourselves. And so I went to the firm and I asked them to transfer me to the Middle East so that we could be together. And oh, by the way, can you do it ASAP? And I didn't think there was anything wrong with this. Like, what's the big deal? Transfer me from the U.S. to the Middle East? You can do that. And all your skeptics out there that are wondering, well, why didn't he transfer for you? He is in oil and gas, and so the choices were Houston, Texas, or Dubai. I chose Dubai, so. So, you know, you're probably starting to see, I went into this decision completely led by my heart. And so, you know, I was sitting there going, look at me, I'm like doing something based on my personal life, how cool am I? And you know, I really felt like the firm should probably be just as happy for me as I am as proud to be open and honest about why I'm making this decision. And what happened is I failed to recognize that the minute I asked for that transfer, I put myself in a negotiation process. And man or woman, when you do that, when you're in a negotiation process, you better make sure you've done your homework. You better make sure you understand what are the needs, the gaps, the objectives of the other side of the table. And you better be comfortable and confident in the value proposition that you can bring to the table. And let me tell you, I was none of that. I was just an open book. And so one thing that was really important to my story is that I didn't even consider what the Middle East might have been thinking when they got my request. At the time, there were no female partners. It was a male-dominated business community. And so it's pretty easy to see where the decision makers were probably looking at me going, okay, what can she contribute and how can she fit in as a partner in our partnership or our organization? So the initial response was no. And really the next part of my story was probably the first aha moment that I had. And it was the first time that I realized and had experienced personally the power and the importance of sponsorship. So after I got the no answer, I was devastated. I mean, I honestly thought I was going to have to quit EY to get what I wanted, which is transfer to Middle East and be with Sean, my husband. And that was devastating to me. Fast forward a couple weeks, I get this email from one of the leaders in the Middle East making me an offer to join the Middle East partnership. Later, what I found out was that the most senior female partner at EY at the time heard my story. And she did her background check. She wanted to make sure she wasn't endorsing a crazy person. But she went and she became my sponsor. And she persuaded the Middle East leadership to take a chance on me. And what she did is she centered it around the business imperatives that sometimes you have to put women in these opportunities and that you have to be deliberate about the decisions you make to really drive inclusiveness and equality. So I got to the Middle East and very quickly had that, oh crap, be careful what you ask for. And the first 6 months, they were awful. I would have taken a one-way ticket anywhere, and I mean anywhere. And I would have said, you know, Sean, figure out a way to meet me because I'm out of here. And the reason was is because I was a fish out of water. I was completely unprepared to deal with that culture. I approached everything like I did when I was in the U.S. I approached it like I was an American, and I made so many mistakes as a result. And what is really pointed out to me now as a talent leader and someone who's really focused on the development of our people is as an organization, it's our responsibility to make sure that we train and prepare our people to work with and team with people that are different than ourselves and to help our people really raise what I call that cultural intelligence. So now here I am, you know, I'm realizing two things, sponsorship and the importance of really helping our people integrate and be more culturally aware. So then really the last part of my story and really where the big lesson that we've learned and really kind of what centers around this panel is that recently I was telling my story to someone. Someone wanted to transfer to somewhere in Europe and was trying to get some advice of what it was like to work overseas. And a young female professional from EY kind of overheard our story. And she looked at me and she goes, have you ever been discriminated against by the firm? Were you discriminated against in the Middle East? And I looked at her and was like, no, because I'm in the back of my mind, I'm going, no, EY doesn't discriminate. And, you know, since then, I kind of reflected on that question. And now what I think she was really asking me, did I have equal pay? And when I now think about if that was her question that she was truly asking me, I would have answered it differently. I wasn't paid equally. And when I went into the Middle East, they set my partner distribution, if you will, as if I was a new partner. They didn't take into account the 3 years that I had had prior to as a partner in the US. So I was being paid much less than my male counterparts who had similar experience and similar years as a partner. But here's the thing, and this might upset some of you in the audience, I take a big chunk of that responsibility. I drove that to happen. You know, if I go back to the point I made about negotiation, needing to know what the other side of the table's gaps and needs and priorities are, and making sure I'm confident about the value proposition I had. And if I would have looked at this differently, if I would have gone into this with that mindset versus the, oh, I'm making this personal decision, look how great I am, help me get there, what I would have found out was that the Middle East at the time had a, and I'm getting the stop, so just one second. At the time, the Middle East had a critical need, and they had a real gap. And I had the experience. I was highly skilled in what it is that they needed. And had I known that, I could have actually gone into the negotiation and been, okay, you have this need. I want to transfer. I want these additional opportunities that are going to grow me as a professional. Let's work together. Let's figure out how we do this. And, you know, and I sit there and I think, well, potentially if I would have gone at it from that direction, maybe we would have taken that whole, like, she's a female, we don't know how to deal with that, and let's just say no. I could have neutralized that and maybe actually had a real meaningful conversation and really could have talked about the value. And you know what? And at the end, I could have been like, hey, and pay me for it. So that's my story and valuable lessons learned around the importance of negotiation.
Thank you. So this is the part of the session in which I'm supposed to say something about a key takeaway for each speaker. But as I was sitting there thinking about what's my key takeaway, I realized that there's really the one theme here this morning in public policy and legislation, in women in positions of leadership, and in negotiation is women need a village of women. When I walked into the speaker's room this morning, a very lovely young woman walked up to me and said, take off your glasses, let me be a sister, and then she started to smooth out some makeup. So it's true that we do naturally what most men in business, God bless them, I love them, what most men in business do not do, which is that we forward one another's interests. And when we do that structurally, when we decide we're going to forward one another's interests in a commercial sense, that we're going to take power, that we're going to pass legislation. By the way, I think our husbands were at Yale at the same time. Because he had 9 women in his class, too. Huh? And he's learned a lot about feminism since he married me in 2010. When we have women who come together with legislation, when we have women who come together and simply walk into the room as if they belong there, no permission once again, subverting the agenda. Right? It didn't come down from Mount Sinai, and having sponsorship. So I think that that's the key today. And what I'd like to do is to open up the room to you, because that is what we are here today for, to find out what problems you have. And I urge you to ask the speakers who did not have nearly enough time to share with you this morning what they can help you with to grab power, to take it, to use it, and to fit the workplace to you instead of trying to fit the starry, shining shape of your person into some male-dominated cubicle. So it's open to you, ladies.
Microphones.
And there are microphones. So please line up behind microphones. So, and just to remind you, I think everybody will be fine with their first names. It is Jenny.
Jay.
I'm sorry. Mm. It is Jay, Heidi.
Ginny. Heidi, Ginny.
Thank you so much.
Hello, good morning. So my first question is, pay is generally a tabooed subject. How does one realize that the pay is not equal compared to your peers? Because we hardly talk about it with our colleagues, and it's how does one know that it's like we're not getting the equal pay, or we are getting equal pay, or maybe even some cases more than what we the others are getting? So how did you realize when you went to Middle East that you weren't getting?
Well, mine was a bit more straightforward. So like I said, I know that they brought me in at the partner distribution of what a first year partner was. So I probably did know right then that I was being paid less. I think I justified it or rationalized it thinking, oh, well, the pay in the Middle East, it's different. So, but I'm still being paid what my male counterparts of being a partner for 3 years are. And it became evident. I mean, there's things that occur like around the partner distribution process that really highlight it. But looking back now, I mean, the writing was on the wall. I mean, I had my offer. It was what I was making as a first-year partner, so I should have known right then that, looking back, I did know right then that I was being paid less.
So, Heidi, how does a woman at a lower level than partner find out about whether or not she's being paid equally?
Well, it is good to get a group of women. That's always helpful. And it turns out nowadays, these firms are so big and there's so much like equality and integration that a lot of women are married to men who work for the same firm. And I certainly heard a lot, and their buddies are willing to share their pay with the guys. So if you have some interactions like that, get to know somebody really well and share your pay. It's difficult, but once you do it, you know, it's all out there. And I think that's very helpful. But I think it's good to do it in a group. And pay transparency is something that really helps. Now, in the case of the partnership distribution, that was a relatively transparent system. Mm-hmm. And we don't all have that. Public sector, why do we have more equality between men and women in the public sector? Pay is open. You can look up everybody's pay on Capitol Hill in a book. And you know what all the grades and steps are in the civil service in most state and city governments as well as the federal. And only about and less than half of private sector workers say that they could share pay information without retaliation. Technically, that's already protected by law, but lots of states have already put in new laws to make sure there's no retaliation for sharing pay information. So that's a new frontier in a sense, just getting an extra law to solidify what we should already have, kind of like Lilly Ledbetter, but you know, it's good we're doing it.
Jay. So I don't know if you saw, but recently Salesforce had two women in Salesforce, who's a big internet company, who basically openly challenged the CEO to prove that he was paying women equally. And he was like, sure, I'll take that challenge. Of course I pay women equally. And then sort of with some chagrin, a few months later, he came back and had to increase his payrolls to women by $3 million annually. Yeah. So I think a lot of this is just reporting. And we don't have transparent reporting in the United States, especially in the private sector. And that's something that's going to have to change if we're ever going to get to pay equity. And so there's a lot of, you know, women first came into the workforce in the 1940s when during World War II, Rosie the Riveter, because the economy demanded it. But it wasn't until the 1970s that all the laws banning women from working without their husband's permission were fully repealed. And it won't be until the economy fully demands it that women will come fully into the workforce. And that's actually closer than we think. So by the year 2030, the baby boomer generation will have fully aged out of the workforce, and we will be short 26 million workers, which is actually hard to imagine considering the employment deficit that we just went through, the sort of recession
But there's only two ways to solve that shortfall. One, you bring in a ton more immigration, which is hard to imagine with this Congress. Or two, you bring women up to full employment, and that almost completely solves the gap. It brings in 23 million new workers into the workforce. And so whomever the next president is going to be, no matter whom he or she is, they will have to deal with this issue. And it's not going to happen naturally. It's going to have to be some sort of, most likely, a public-private partnership where you challenge companies to begin to more transparently report these things. The best one I found in my research was the slightly unfortunately named group called the Male Champions for Change in Australia. They're doing amazing work. Not just women on boards, but they've increased women's protected participation in the executive workforce to 47%. They've tripled the number of women on boards in the last 6 years, and they've done a lot with just frankly shaming CEOs. So shame is a powerful tool.
Yeah, shame is one of the contentious negotiation tactics.
So my question's kind of similar, actually, and that was the first half of my question, so transitions well. So once you identify that you're not having fair pay, how do you, like, increase the gap? Because, I don't know, a lot of companies are like, well, we can't increase your pay that much, right, going along those lines.
Well, I think legally they have to, don't they? I mean, once you report that you have a pay gap, it's against the law for them to pay you less.
As a lawyer... I will say that may be true, but that you're not going to threaten your law firm with a lawsuit.
Sorry, I guess when I say fair, it's not just like 88 cents to the dollar, but maybe you're just like not being paid. There may be like men and women who are not paid as much as like the men and women who are also the same experience.
So, negotiation.
How would you negotiate well to get...
Okay, I'm going to ask Ginny to ask that question because she's in charge of talent, and then I'll tell you from the point of view of someone who consults with women on higher pay.
I guess if I use my own story, when I realized that there was a pay gap, where I chose to then decide to start negotiating was in my annual performance process review. And I came to the table prepared to really point out what it was that I contributed and why I should be acknowledged for it, compensated for it, what have you. And because in partner process, rating has a big play in terms of your distribution. So that was really how, you know, I started to bridge that gap once I realized it was there. You know, when I look at what some of our younger professionals do, it is back to what Jay kind of said. It is sort of that they come with the question, and it's on the onus of us to really prove one way or the other if there is a pay gap, and to help them understand if there is a pay gap. If it's a justified pay gap, I think there is some ownership to recognize that.
So I think that. It's very difficult to prove pay gap. It's difficult to prove it. Mm. Stop. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. We have so much we want to tell you. So the answer to the question, really, from the point of view of someone who consults with women, is that you need a plan. You need a negotiation plan. As soon as you have a negotiation plan, you have power. Because you are negotiating with someone who doesn't know they're negotiating with you. And as we learned, the most dangerous negotiation in the world is one you don't know you're having. I negotiated as a lawyer with an opponent. I now negotiate with people who don't know they're being negotiated with. There is nobody on the other side who has a countervailing plan. So you need a plan. You need to know what your value is. Pick the top of the range. Has anybody in the room ever been at like 50% on any standardized test you ever took? Don't take the average. All my women want to take the average. Go to the top of the range. Talk about your value to the company. Are you driving revenue? Are you saving costs? Are you creating profits? And get what you deserve. Let me tell you, there are a lot of resources on our site, shenegotiates.com. There's a whole comprehensive negotiation outline. So I would start there, go to payscale.com, go to Glassdoor, learn what your market value is,
and gather your sponsors around you and ask a lot of questions about what the organization needs. And go to shenegotiates.com because I don't have nearly enough time to answer the question. But thank you for raising it. It's a difficult one for everyone, even men.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Those were great questions. I really wish we could have kept going. I could sit for another hour for sure, but we are up against a number of other sessions. First of all, I want to thank all the speakers for the great job and for the connections that you've made. Thank you very much. I'd also like to mention that both Vicki and Jay will be signing books in the exhibit hall. So if you want to go over there now, that actually is going to happen right now for the next 30 minutes. And we'll go over there with you right after this to get books signed.
Oh, thank you so much.
Vicki's authored two books, and Jay's just written a book called Broad Influence. So I want to encourage you to go over there. Again, thank you for being here, and look forward to seeing you in a little while. Thanks, everybody.
I have cards, too.